Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. Dorothy Gundy and Kaveh Rezaei will report on efforts to keep hackers from affecting the American presidential election.
It would require considerable technical sophistication.
Dr. Jill Robbins will tell us about a sports program in New York City that is improving the lives of poor children.
The program is built on the life skills that baseball teaches: confidence, perseverance, and sportsmanship.
It has helped more than 2,000 children since it was founded in 1991. John Russell will tell us the beautiful and haunting story of how the mystery of a man's death in Cambodia was solved by his daughter as she was writing a novel.
You can be brutal, and you can bring terror, and you can become a dictator, but that's not going to kill the human spirit, and that's what I want my book to show.
And Anne Ball will tell us about some new species discovered at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean.
I think it's likely we're going to develop at least some aspects of these deep ocean environments, and we should try and do that with knowledge in hand, and do it in a way that's going to minimize our impact.
So, you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So, let's get started.
As recently as 2014, people could use Wi-Fi to connect to voting machines inside certain voting places in the state of Virginia. They simply had to be nearby. Once connected, they could interfere with ballots. That major problem in election security has been fixed. Virginia stopped using those machines last year. But election cybersecurity is getting a closer look. Republican Party presidential nominee Donald Trump has repeatedly suggested that the election in November may be rigged, and a politically sensitive hacking of the Democratic National Committee computer system increased public concern about election cybersecurity. Security experts say the risks are real, but the probability of attacks on voting cyber systems is hard to estimate.
David Wagner is a computer science professor at the University of California at Berkeley. He worked on a 2007 statewide examination of California's voting system. He says a sophisticated attacker could hack machines and steal votes. He says every machine is at risk. But such a hack would not be easy, he says.
It would require considerable technical sophistication. And it would require someone to be physically present in each county, tampering with at least one machine in each county. This is not something that some random teenager can do over a weekend. It's not something that can be done across the world over the internet.
The best defense against cheating is a system that has a hard copy ballot and a system in place to look for ballot irregularities. These systems are on the rise. This November, 75% of voters across the United States will vote on machines that retain a hard copy of their choices, says Verified Voting. It is an election observation organization. Also, 26 states require ballot audits after the voting. But that leaves 25% of voters entering ballots with no paper copy. And nearly half of the 50 states do not require audits. Wagner says a lot more can and should be done to improve cybersecurity. But he adds, we've come a long way in protecting our elections.
If attackers want to hack voting machines, they would have to get to them first. Most of them are under lock and key, says Denise Merrill, Connecticut Secretary of State and President of the National Association of Secretaries of State. Usually, they are under two keys, in fact, one for a Republican representative and one for a Democrat. Both keys are required to unlock the machine. Local jurisdictions control their elections, and there are more than 7,000 jurisdictions nationwide. The voting equipment and methods differ widely from place to place. As a result, security can differ widely. But that also means an attack on one jurisdiction would not affect the others. Secretary of State Merrill says someone who is really determined and had a very large operation might be able to attack. But, she says, even then, it would have to be in very specific places.
Pam Smith is president of Verified Voting, the election observation organization. She says more states are already moving toward paper ballots and increased physical security of voting equipment.
I think what will happen as we go forward is that people will want to have any and every extra tool they can to eliminate any lingering concerns or questions that people might have.
The U.S. Homeland Security Secretary, Jay Johnson, spoke to state election officials Monday. He offered them help in finding and fixing election cybersecurity risks. The department is considering designating the nation's election systems as critical infrastructure. The government provides extra resources to protect critical infrastructure.
Verified Voting's Pam Smith has another idea for anyone concerned about possible election cheating.
It's not too late to sign up to be a poll worker. You can learn more about it from the inside out and see what some of the safeguards are.
On November 8th, those safeguards, as well as the presidential candidates, will be put to the test. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Kaveh Razai.
A baseball program in New York City continues to help East Harlem children escape poverty. The program is named Harlem RBI. The program was founded in 1991. The community is now celebrating the 25th anniversary of Harlem RBI. Close to 2,000 boys and girls have become part of Harlem RBI's success. In 1991, East Harlem was filled with public housing and parks covered with asphalt. East Harlem was a neighborhood filled with minorities. The community had a high poverty rate. Students had trouble reading and understanding mathematics in school. Marilyn Morales is a former resident of East Harlem. She said East Harlem was very scary in 1991. The neighborhood was filled with homeless people, drug addicts, and buildings destroyed by fire. Morales now lives in Westchester County, New York. Westchester County is close to 40 kilometers from East Harlem. She is now a mother who drives to New York City every day. Her son plays in Harlem RBI's Summer League. The children are now part of a success rate instead of a poverty rate. Harlem RBI added a charter school program of its own, called DREAM, in 2008. DREAM students perform better than students in the state, city, and school districts. DREAM teaches a high number of special needs students and English language learners. Almost all Harlem RBI students graduate from high school. Nearly all Harlem RBI players have been able to enter college over the past 11 years. Richard Berlin is the executive director of Harlem RBI. He started with Harlem RBI as a volunteer coach in 1994. He said, "The charter school fills every one of our seats with a deserving child who wants to be here." Berlin said, "Lessons on a baseball field can lead to a life of success." "Baseball is a game of failure," he said. "If you fail 7 out of 10 times in baseball, you are wildly successful in this game." Morales said the program and ball games help her son stay focused in life.
It keeps him off drugs, hopefully, and it just helps keep him, you know, motivated and focused in life.
Taina Figueroa is an 8th grader and a shortstop and pitcher in the league. She has been with Harlem RBI for 6 years. Figueroa said the program is built on the life skills that baseball teaches: confidence, perseverance, and sportsmanship. "When people are on your side and they are rooting for you, it gives me motivation to hit the ball harder or pitch harder or run faster," Figueroa said. The program just received $85 million to improve the school building. And many former East Harlem residents would like to move back home, but the neighborhood is not the same. Morales says she wishes she could move back today, but it's not that simple. "It's too expensive. I can't live here," she said, laughing. I'm Jill Robbins.
Sometimes writing a fictional work can help the writer deal with painful trauma. That was Verini Yim's experience when she wrote her first novel, The Immigrant Princess. Yim is Cambodian-American. Her book tells about 3 generations of women from Cambodia's ruling family who try to rebuild their lives in the United States. However, it was Yim's father who became central to her while writing the novel. I only have a few memories of my father, and one of the most heartbreaking memories for me is the day that we left Cambodia. He had taken us to the airport, she said. I was too young to understand what was happening, and I remember walking up the stairs to the airplane and looking back on the tarmac, and my father waved at us. What I didn't realize was that would be the last time that I would ever see my father's face. Verini Yim, her sister, and her grandparents escaped before the Cambodian genocide. Her father, who stayed in Cambodia to care for aging parents, was a victim of it. Over 4 years, supporters of the Khmer Rouge killed about 2 million people. Yim and her family joined her mother, who was studying in the United States. Yim said they owe their lives to her grandfather, who made sure they left Cambodia. They were all members of Cambodia's royal family. Yim's mother was a princess in Cambodia, but in the United States, she was just another refugee. Her family had to change their expectations about life. They had no money, and their position meant almost nothing in the United States, Yim explained. She added that her family tried to keep their royal identity close to themselves. They did not tell many people about who they were. As a young girl in the U.S., Yim said, the Cambodian genocide seemed very far away. She did not think about what it meant that her father might have been killed with many other Cambodians. This changed when she started researching Cambodian history while writing her book. The details of her father's death had always been a mystery she solved while doing research for the book. Her research led her to Cornell University in New York. The university has records of the statements given by the Khmer Rouge's victims at Dul Slang Prison. Those held there were questioned, tortured, and killed. According to some estimates, 14,000 people entered the prison. Only a small number of these people survived. In Cornell's archive of confessions was proof of what happened to Yim's father during the genocide. One of the hardest days of my life was when I got an email from Cornell confirming that they had found my father's name and confession, said Yim. It was finally wonderful to know the truth. The truth really sets you free, even if it was painful. Guided by the memory of the family she had lost, Yim said she needed to write The Immigrant Princess to face the past. She also wanted to remember the beauty in Cambodian culture. Yim explained that her novel shows universal themes about identity and reinvention. She said the book is about how a person survives a traumatic loss. You can be brutal, and you can bring terror, and you can become a dictator, but that's not going to kill the human spirit, and that's what I want my book to show, Yim said. Yim added that she wrote the book for her children, so they will know what happened. She also wrote the book for Cambodians, so that they will know that the genocide may have left a scar, but does not define them as a people. I'm John Russell.
Researchers hired to study part of the deep seafloor of the Pacific Ocean found a surprising number of new animal species. Scientists at the University of Hawaii at Manoa studied a 900 square kilometer area in the eastern part of the Pacific Ocean known as the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, or CCZ. Their goal was to find and study new kinds of sea life. Their task included documenting what is living in the deep sea area known as an abyss. The researchers published their findings in the journal Nature Scientific Reports. Diva Amon is a researcher at the University of Hawaii. She is assistant director of the Abyss Line Project to study undersea life. She spoke with VOA on Skype from her laboratory in Hawaii. Amon says, usually deep-sea biologists think there is not a lot living in the abyss.
But we found that actually there is quite a lot living there, and so that was really exciting.
The group is studying the area because the CCZ is known to have valuable minerals, including copper, nickel, and cobalt. The metals are found in pieces 5 to 10 centimeters in size, called nodules. They are spread along the seafloor from 3,000 to 6,000 meters below the ocean's surface. The CCZ is a huge, flat area of seabed, almost the size of the United States. It is located between the mountainous Clarion and Clipperton fracture zones. These are areas where the Earth's crust is cracked or fractured. The CCZ sits between Central America and the Hawaiian Islands. The International Seabed Authority, ISA, is permitting the company UK Seabed Resources Limited to explore the area on the Pacific Ocean floor for mining. However, the ISA said the company must first complete a biological study of the area before it can begin mining for metals. So, the company hired Diva Amon and the Abyss Line Project. Their job is to find out what sea life exists in the area. They want to know how marine life depends on the mineral deposits on the ocean floor. Amon says that more than half of the animals they collected were completely new to science.
So it just shows how much more work really needs to be done in that area because we know so little.
Her group discovered a new species of anemone and two new species of sponges. But three of the animals Amon collected were not only new species, but new categories of animals. Two of these are in the coral family, and the third is a completely new genus and species. Paul Snellgrove is a biological oceanographer with the Memorial University of Newfoundland in Canada. He told VOA that finding new species in the deep ocean is common, but he said finding a new genus is really quite profound. Amon's work centers on the relationship between the living things and the metallic nodules. She found that more than half of the animals collected were attached to the nodules. The CCZ seabed is a soft, flat seafloor. The nodules provide the only hard surface where many creatures can attach themselves. Amon warns that if mining happens across the entire area, the ecosystem would be, in her words, decimated. But she says scientists want to find the least damaging way to make mining possible.
There's a sort of scientific push to try and slow things a bit so that the science can be done before, so that this can be done as sustainably and least impacting as possible.
That is why these studies are so important, says Snellgrove, who is not part of the Abyss Line project.
I think it's likely we're going to develop at least some aspects of these deep ocean environments, and we should try and do that with knowledge in hand and do it in a way that's going to minimize our impact.
The Abyss Line project has 5 years to study deep sea life in the eastern Pacific. Amon expects that more new life forms will be discovered on future trips. She says she is studying data. She calls the deep sea a fascinating place. There are so many things there that no one has ever seen before that are weird and wonderful.
We need to be careful, and hopefully by doing the studies that we're doing, we can provide the data that will be used for managing the area as best as possible.
The deep sea is one of the last areas on Earth that has not been greatly affected by humans. So there could be many strange new worlds yet to explore. I'm Ann Ball.
That's our program for today. We'd like to hear what you think of it. You can send us an email. Our address is learningenglish@voanews.com. Or send us a message through our website. Just go to learningenglish.voanews.com and click Contact Us. While you are there, you can read, listen to, and download our programs. You will also find captioned videos and lessons to test your American English skills. Please know that however you reach us, we do read every message you send. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. You can follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, iTunes, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel, all at VOA Learning English. And be sure to listen to VOA World News at the beginning of every hour, Universal Time, every day of the year. We hope this program has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.